In general, has Benedict understood humility, unlike as many others, perhaps popularly conceive it, humility is mainly directed towards God. Our practice of humility, as we shall see, will indeed involve our social life. But humility, per se, is first the right relationship towards God. That's the first step. A filial fear of God. This, of course, is not servile fear. It is the kind of fear that a child or anyone has not to offend someone you love. It is filial because it is the fear of a son or daughter, a filius or a filia. The fear not precisely that God will punish, but the fear that I will betray the one that has been so good to me. Second, self-distrust. Realizing how prone I am to sin, knowing that my own will is so weak, I distrust myself. But watch this Benedictine nuance. It is not only or even mainly distrust of my will for being weak. That too, of course. It is mainly distrust of my will for being blind. It's not just strength that I lack. It's light. It's knowledge. It's wisdom. And if you read the scriptures from these perspectives, it's remarkable how much men like Benedict and Francis and Dominic discovered in the Bible that the rest of us read too. Third, if we are thus blind and therefore should distrust ourselves, evidently, we must trust someone. Oh, that's easy. Benedict would say, that's what superiors are for. In other words, they are the ones who enlighten our admittedly, provided a person admits it, inadequate will. Blind in not being able to see, and weak even though it sees what should be done, but, as St. Paul so humbly admitted, but we tend to do what we're not supposed to. Obedience, therefore, to the superior's will. So distrust of self-will is a precondition for trusting God's providence that he would not have allowed me. This is Benedict's thesis. God would not allow a sincere soul to entrust itself to another human being and then not have that other human being supply for what the person needs. And with the church's approval of that, we are thereby saying that the first condition for religious knowing what should be done is inquiring the superior's mind. Those three go together, and they are the first set, which are the steps towards humility on the interior level. The 8 to 12 will be the exterior ones. Fourth step. Now he's got the religious under obedience. But obedience to the superior's will is not yet as high a degree as the next step is, because It's all very well for me to trust the superior's will. It's something else, how shall I put it, to put up with the superior. Patience under obedience. Because it's not as though once I've resolved to be obedient, gee, this is great. I thought life was difficult. All you've got to do is be obedient. Trials, sufferings, the cross, that's all past history. Oh, no. Because this divine providence, somehow directing the docile soul through obedience, is positively uncanny in the things that the one who had originally said, I'm going to be obedient, big me, I'm going to be obedient, come what may. Well, come what may, but I didn't expect this. Is this obedience too? No, that's obedience too. There must be some mistake. No. In other words, there is such a thing as being tried under obedience by all the manner of means that obedience can try us. Sometimes a superior, usually what we're told to do. Fifth, in order for the soul of the religious that wants to give itself totally to God, to be directed by obedience the way, well, obedience should direct. Since the superior is not God, God knows what's on my mind before I tell him. The superior doesn't, it's just as well. But, if we could coin a phrase, obedience should be patient, but obedience should also be enlightened. In other words, I must have the humility to manifest myself to the one who is to direct me sufficiently, well, to enable that authority to be exercised the way it should, so that I might not be told to do things or forbidden to do others, which in one case I'm not up to, and the others that I should do. It is not, therefore, obedience to obey like an automat. And if, I don't know what kind of automats you have, but in New York City, many of them just don't work. You put your quarter in, and well, you put the quarter in. And what I've done sometime, I press the other, see if I can get some change back. Then I watched one man. This was an automat on the train. He put in whatever was 50 cents for a packet of cigarettes. 50 cents, two quarters dropped in, no cigarettes. And I was sitting just in front of him where the automat was. He pressed, he pushed, he began to talk to the machine. Since nothing happened, he began to kick. So, if even automats are not automatic, human beings cannot guide us unless they know whom they're guiding. As one who has guided religious most of my priestly life, beginning with my Jesuits whom I was teaching, not many classes, 9 hours at most a week, but I've stopped counting the number of hours they keep me in counseling far into the night. One of the hardest things for some people is to manifest themselves. Now that doesn't mean telling everything, because there are some things that maybe we shouldn't tell. It's not just like a broken records, going over a lot of things, repeating them. It's not bringing up all kinds of sordid details. It's to know what I am to manifest so that the one who is directing me will know whom he or she is directing. So, manifestation of conscience, a prosaic phrase for a very important step, to be exact, number 5, on the way to Christian perfection by way of humility. Most of us like to keep, and this we sometimes tell ourselves, well, at least this is my own. At least I can keep my own thoughts. Well, not quite. Now, clearly, there's a difference. Unless my superior is a priest and the circumstances are such that I am to manifest myself, if I wish, in the society of Jesus, we have the privilege of manifesting our consciences to our priest superiors under the seal of confession. Superiors, or those who direct us, do not have the right to in any way compel or coerce. And there are even canons in canon law forbidding compulsion by whatever means, straightforward or devious. But if that's the duty for the superior, the religious has the corresponding duty. A religious is obliged to manifest as much of his or her conscience as, before God they believe, the one who is to do the direction should know to be able to direct them as the life requires. In case of doubt, a person could ask, say, a confessor to find out, should I say this? Do I have to? Well, my recommendation to religious has always been, rather say more than less. I'm talking to the religious, understand, not the superior. They are totally at the mercy of the individual. Right? In any case, manifestation of conscience. 6. Only the saints could talk this language. Joy in recognizing one's own worthlessness. Now you say to yourself, oh no. Joy we understand, worthlessness we understand, but not joy in recognizing one's worthlessness. So what's the source of the joy? Clearly, it is not the being worthless, not the being weak or sinful. Guess. It is that provided I humbly acknowledge that of myself I am nothing, and I mean it before God, God will take over in my soul and give me every reason for rejoicing. If there is any sort of source of sadness we should have, it should be reliance on self. That doesn't mean we don't use our wills. It doesn't mean that we don't exercise our freedom. It does mean that we realize that of ourselves, except for the grace of God, we could not live up to the demands that He makes on our souls. 7th, let me finish this. I'm watching that clock carefully. You might say 6 is bad enough. But then he adds, 7, conviction of one's own nothingness and God's majesty. Now, Where joy is in the will and emotions, conviction is in the mind. Those two phrases, one's own nothingness and God's majesty, are to be taken side by side. In other words, clearly we are not nothing. We are something. And indeed, in God's eyes, we are precious. But compared with God, that's what we are. Nothing. Now, that really is the basis of humility, because man compared with God is infinite. No matter what we've got, we are finite. And even that finitude, such as it is, 120 or 30 pounds of body that we've got and whatever else there is to us, even that little which we call our own, which we treasure so dearly, even that, except for the will of God, wouldn't exist. In fact, we can change that subjunctive mood. Except for the will of God, not only would we not exist, we do not exist except for the will of God. No contrast our minds can show us between who God is and what we are would mirror the reality. We cannot be less nothing than to depend on the will of God, even to be. He made up his will to make us. He can make up his will to unmake us. And that's it. That constant realization, how many times I've had to tell myself, especially when sometimes things get hard, God is behind it. Who am I to question his providence? Doesn't make sense. From the grossest kind of injustice. But who am I? The last five of the 12 steps of humility are essentially with its external practice. The eighth step talks about conforming oneself to the rule and practicing the humility of universality. This, as I've found out, is one of the hardest forms of humility to practice. We are all congenitally and understandably individuals. The menus in a restaurant, the women's designs along Fifth Avenue in New York. Each one of us wants to be an individual. Even to the choice, for example, of the dressing on your salad. What difference, objectively, in the metaphysical order does it make? Whether it's French, or mayonnaise, or Thousand Island, or, I've seen, Green Goddess, Russian, and other languages. We want to remain ourselves. I live with villagers long enough. I've taught them for too many years not to know that the hardest thing, I don't say to shed, we're not meant to shed our personalities. But in religious life, and Benedict made it very plain, the first of the steps that have to do with the external practice of humility, to sacrifice our individuality for the sake of universality. And he is conditioned for thus sacrificing one's personal distinctive individuality is to keep the rule, because by definition the rule is the same for all. When that bell rings in the morning, according to rule, not two of us have exactly the same metabolism, have exactly, down to the minute, the same need of sleep. It may be just 5 or 10 minutes more, and you're sure, when that bell rings, we need more. The bell rings, and we begin to sacrifice our individuality if we get up on time. The uniform garb in a religious institute, the going to meals at the same time, and what no restaurant could survive, I would say, for 3 weeks. Always, everyone gets the same. Now, there are certain options, but not that many. In New York, it's very simple. You can exercise your option. But what you don't take, at least in the Jesuit house, somebody else will. They waste very little food. That's the 8th step. Conformity to rule, no singularity. When on rare occasion the Lord visits us and we receive extraordinary gifts to embarrass us as being specially gifted, if we're going to be singular, let it be the Lord who makes us singular. Number 9. A law that is not much used nowadays, taciturnity. What does that taciturnity mean? Somebody who has a grasp of vocabulary. I'm seeing heads shaken. Taciturnity. Oh, yes.
Being quiet.
Speak what?
Being quiet.
Being quiet. Being quiet. All right. I'm building on the Latin. Benedict wrote his rule in Latin. He spoke of tacere, from which the English word taciturnity is derived. That is not quite the same as silere. You see, the ancient Greeks and Romans, they had a lot of words for things that we pretty much, doesn't matter to us, what word you use. Yeah, not quite. Being taciturn is a little different and more than just being silent. Silence is essentially negative. I just don't talk. Maybe I have nothing to say. Maybe I don't want to say it. Maybe I don't want to say it to this person. Or I'm just in a silent mood. Taciturnity is no mere absence of speech. It is indeed silence, but with a purpose. A taciturn person is a person who does not speak Because given the circumstances here and now, they either call for not saying anything or saying just, say, 20 words and not 25. A taciturn person does not necessarily not speak, but tries to adjust his or her speech to the purpose for speaking. In other words, taciturnity is wise silence, or silence that is thinking.
This concludes the first part of Father John Hardin's lecture on the rise and growth of Western monasticism. Part 2 will be found on the next tape.